Facebook Live and RadioBuzz.com. This is No Limit People with Dr. Will Horton.
Hi. Do you dream of a better life? That better life may be a better physical body, maybe more money, maybe better relationships. It could be a lot of things. But I want you to know it's not your fault that you don't have it. There are people, places, and things that try to hold information back that stops you from living the life that you dream. Hi, I'm Dr. Will Horton, and really my dream is to help you live those no-limit lives. A few years ago, I was exposed to some techniques and technology that changed my life in ways it's hard for me to describe. And so that's why we do No Limit People, NLP for the real world. Every show has a topic that is about releasing limits. And within every show, we also talk about a life hack or a brain hack that'll help you break some of those limits to live a no-limit life. So today I'd like to talk about something that, by conservative estimations, 175 United States citizens will die today from, which is overdose addictions. And that's actually a very low number when you think about it, because when that's just basically the opioid epidemic overdoses. When you add in alcohol and you add in other drugs with that, it goes even higher. And that's not even adding in when you do things like DUIs and some other things that go with that. And of course, we gotta really realize that certain people may die of an overdose addiction or an alcohol-related illness, but it's not going to be listed that way on their death report, because maybe they got money, maybe they got connections, so it could be due to like heart failure or some other issue. So, but I want to talk about what's going on with this and what it is. And so today I want to talk about addictions in the 21st century. So first of all, we must realize that basically, especially how we look at addictions, has not changed in over 45 to 50 years. It's pretty much stagnant. And with that, the way we treat addictions has not really changed in 45 or 50 years, which is fascinating when you think about the explosion of technology, what we know about neurology and neurochemicals and all the things that are going on. Yet the treatment of addictions has pretty much remained stagnant. In fact, it's one of the only fields where if someone goes in and gets any kind of treatment, whether it's 12-state-based or cognitive behavioral-based or however it is, if they don't do well, if they come out and they have some issues, they blame the person with the disease. And that's fascinating, because if somebody has heart trouble and they go get help with their heart and then they have more heart issues, they don't yell at them. But we do that with addictions. So what I wanted to point out was some things that it really started to shift. And there's some movement going on wanting to look at the world of addictions slightly differently. And again, today we're being sponsored by the Alcohol and Addiction Solution Facebook page. If you like, please click on that, make a comment, and click like and share this. There'll be more information on that page soon. And I've been in the addiction field for almost 40 years. I've been personally, I'm in recovery, have been for almost 35 years. But what I wanted to talk about is some of the things that changed how I looked at addiction. Because like a lot of people that was in the addiction fields, alcohol and drug counselor, and then became a psychologist, and I've run inpatient, outpatient alcohol and drug treatment units. I've ran a psychiatric unit at a Florida state prison. I've worked in the jails and a lot of other things. And yet I had that traditional model in my mind. And I knew that it didn't work for a lot of people that went to get help. And yet we would blame the people rather than maybe we need to tweak how we're looking at the whole addiction model. And let me share with you what really shifted my thinking. And that was, the whole war on drugs in the United States, the whole zero tolerance of alcohol and drugs in America. I mean, remember going back in the 20s, we had prohibition where it was alcohol. Well, now it's moved to drugs. We all know how well that's done. but there was a study done, and what it was, they took some rats. I call this the happy rat study, but they took some rats and they hooked them on some drugs. It was, I think it was heroin and cocaine. And I know this, it's been duplicated with alcohol. So anyway, they get the rat hooked and it's in this little cage. And, you know, we've seen how we do rats. So they're there and they're hooked and they're, you know, they just keep doing it. And then they drop in different food. They drop in a mate. But the rat that's addicted will avoid the food, will avoid the mate, will just keep doing the drugs or the alcohol till it's dead, right? And so, of course, that started the whole zero tolerance. There was a commercial like that where it was like, you know, it's so powerful that, you know, you will avoid food, you will avoid sex, you will just basically do this till you die. So it started the whole zero tolerance, drugs are bad. And it was kind of like that commercial in the 70s where it showed eggs, you know, that would show a skillet. And they would, this is your brain, it would show an egg. And there was, this is your brain on drugs, and it would show eggs cooking. I remember seeing that and thinking, wow, that's an effective commercial. You know, maybe I didn't stop doing drugs, but I quit eating eggs. Anyway, back to the serious subject. So it was kind of fascinating, and it went along, and this was pushed. Of course, the politics picked it up, and that's where we started the war on drugs, which also had some socioeconomic factors built in, because they also criminalized, you know, the drug use, and they linked it to certain subgroups. In the 60s, it was anybody that was anti-war, hippies, if you will, and that was marijuana. And, you know, in the African-American community, heroin and cocaine, because it was, you were going against the norm. And so it criminalized that whole thing. But there was a psychologist that looked at this and said, there's something wrong with this study, because rats, much like people, are very intelligent creatures. If you've ever, and very social, if you've ever had a rat issue in your house or anywhere around you, here in Florida, we get fruit rats. And I can tell you how smart they are and how hard they are to get rid of. So he took the study and he duplicated, he got the rats hooked again, but rather than put like food and things in the cage where the rat got addicted, he took the rat out of the cage and put it in a happy rat cage, you know, where there were other rats and, you know, mates, food, kids, stimulation, things for rats to do, because rats are very smart. And what they found was almost all the rats would not use the alcohol or the drugs when they were dropped into that happy rat cage, right? And it was kind of fascinating. So it's like, even though it was there, they would not, and they were addicted before, they took them out of the unhappy cage, put them in the happy cage, and people quit, or the rats quit using. Well, this also coincided with something going on that some people might remember. It was a long time ago. It was the height of the Vietnam War, and it was called the Tet Offensive. And at the height of the Vietnam War, especially in the late 60s, you know, there was the anti-war movement going on in the United States. It wasn't like, hey, thank you for your service. You know, it was a whole different genre. And so all these soldiers, usually between the age of, you know, the average combat soldier in Vietnam was about 19, because you got drafted at 18 to 20 and you did your 2 years and you came home. So the amount of alcohol and drug issues going on in Vietnam was astronomical, because there was, of course, there was marijuana. There was really good hashish going all around there, and then heroin, because that's right by the triangle. So there's all these dry, and then alcohol was abundant. And, you know, if you ever seen the movie Platoon, you see that you had the drinkers and the druggers, and it was very true. I was in the military a little bit after that, and it's pretty true. Anyway, so there's all these troops, and they were addicted. If we went in with the clinical model of what an addiction is, they were doing it. You know, they were doing it in the face of negative consequences. They were being yelled at by their command. They were getting busted. They were getting yelled at. They didn't care. They kept using. So that's, you know, one of the things of an addiction. So we were gearing up for this huge onslaught of addicted soldiers coming back from Vietnam. And so what happened was the soldiers came back. And, at the height, we had over 500,000 troops in country at any given time for almost 3 years. So all these troops came back. And guess what happened? Most of them adapted back into society quite well. In fact, only about 10% really kept their alcohol and drug problem that they developed in Vietnam, they kept when they came back. There was a slight adjustment period, but then people got back into the groove. So if you look at the rat study, it's like we took them out of the unhappy rat cage, Vietnam, put them back in a happy rat cage where you're from. And once they got acclimated back, they didn't have the drug and the alcohol issue. And it went against everything that most addictionologists would say, even though these people were drinking alcoholically in Vietnam or using drugs. They came back, they were normal, especially the people with the drink. They came back, they might drink, they might not drink, right? It went against everything that we know with addictions at that time. And yet that study has not been talked about enough, because it kind of fits another model which I call the boxes. And what happens in, again, if you like this, please click like and share on the Alcohol and Addiction Solution page. And there'll be more information going up there. It's been something it's one of my passions for the last 30 years is helping people with this issue and helping therapists and people that help people with this issue. So when you look at the Happy Rat study, it kind of coincides with something else, which goes with two other things I'll talk about, which is I call it the boxes, and then also what we know about how habits work in your mind now. What the boxes are is, if you figure most people, you know, you go, when you first start out, you're abstinent from drug and alcohol, right? You never use. But then what happens, most people, especially in the West, you go through a phase where you're going to experiment. As much as most parents say, not my kids, you know, 90-something percent will experiment with alcohol and or some drugs, depending on where they're at. It's just what they do. And then for some of the people, when they experiment, they're going to move into the next little box. If you imagine there's abstinence, you just, you know, you don't use, you don't even think about it. And then you move into, okay, I'm going to experiment. Now, some people like it, and they'll move into the social use stage. You know, they might drink, they might not drink. You know, let's say you're in high school, even though people don't admit kids drink in high school, we know they do. You know, they might go to a party, have a couple of beers, get drunk every once in a while when they go to college. It's no big deal. They're in the social use phase, right? Fine. Great. And those people may go from the social use, then there'll be periods they're abstinent. They just don't drink for whatever reason. They don't feel like it. Maybe they've got work issues, school issues. So they're in the social use / phase. Then what happens for some people, you move into a phase where you're abusing substances, whether it's alcohol or drugs. It could be negative, like the soldiers in Vietnam. They're self-medicating because they're in a horrible situation. But what if we use another scenario? What if somebody goes to college and they join a fraternity or a sorority where, you know, it's binge drinking, you know, Friday through Sunday and the toga parties and the things that are still, there's an epidemic. We always talk about the opioid epidemic. There's an epidemic of binge drinking still on U.S. campuses. So you go to college for 3 years, or you get into, you know, 4 years, but you get into a fraternity your second year, and you're partying, you're drinking like a maniac. You know, you fit all the criteria. You might get in some trouble at school, but you keep partying. Finally, you get out of school, right? Almost 90% of the people that do that will go back to the social use stage. They'll get out of college. And you see people do this in the military. They'll get in, they'll party because, you know, maybe they're on a ship. And every shore leave is a 3-day drunk. When you're not training, you're off partying, things like that. But then when you, let's say, get out of the military, let's say get out of that college, and you go and you get a job, you settle down, you go back into being a social person. You may be abstinent for periods of time. You may drink, you may not drink, right? But then we have the 10% that go from, so we have the abstinence box, the experimentation box, the social use box, the abusive box, and it could be positive, like you're just partying at a college or in the military. It could be like our soldiers in Vietnam, you're in a horrible situation, or it could be depressed. Maybe your parents have just died, or maybe you lost your spouse or something like that. So it's negative. So you're self-medicating with either the alcohol or the drugs. Those are irrelevant which one you use. And then, but then once that situation subsides a little bit, you go back to normal, which again goes against what we would say in most of the addictionology work, right? But you got the 10% that move into the dependence phase. They can't stop. You know, I always say people show up for alcohol and drug treatment because of one of the four L's, you know, your lover, your liver, your livelihood, or the law, right? People don't just wake up on a winning streak and decide, I think I need treatment today for alcohol or drugs. Usually somebody's yelling at them. This, you know, your spouse, your boss, the police, the court, somebody, there's something going on. So the people that move into the addictive box, they're like, and this part, the current thinking goes with it, which is they've moved into where they developed an allergy to the alcohol or drugs. You know, my wife is allergic. I always use her as an example. She's allergic to shellfish. She can't have shellfish. She has shellfish, she gets deathly ill. You know, I'm a recovering alcoholic. If I have alcohol, I get deathly ill. Of course, my illness, I break out, you know, in spots. usually the worst spots in town. Eventually my teeth end up being broke out and I end up arrested, right? She just gets sick. The only difference is she will avoid shellfish at all costs, right? She will make sure we're at a restaurant, especially a Chinese place, she'll make sure they don't cook the food in the same place. And yet we have alcoholics and drug addicts that somehow we try to fight this problem like tooth and nail, this allergy. You know, it's like, I'll eat shellfish this time and won't get sick. It's not going to work. So those people need to go to total abstinence, which is the traditional treatment model. So they go and they go into this, and then they go into they have to stay abstinent. And that's basically the 12-step model, where abstinence is paramount. Now, so what I wanted to point that out, it kind of goes with what we know now about how habits work, which is kind of another fascinating subject, and we'll do a show on that soon about habits. But when a habit is basically you have a cue and you go into a routine, that's how your brain works, and you get the reward of whatever the reward is. Every day after work, you go get a beer, and the reward is, you know, you might think it's the alcohol, but what if the reward is the camaraderie of sitting around a bar, you know, decompressing after work before you go home? Or even when you first come home, you pour a drink. Is it the drink, or is it the reward actually taking a few moments for yourself? And so that, you know, that's the habit cycle. And we know that you can change the habit cycle. And that's what we do with addiction modification training, whatever it happens to be, whether it's the 12-step model, cognitive behavioral, rational emotive, there's all these different treatments. And so what we want to do is look at, you know, how is it that, you know, it's being adapted in the United States. And unfortunately, we still use the same outdated models. We haven't brought in what we know about neurology and the neuroplasticity and the things that are going on. And we don't even figure out, where are you in this model? You know, where are you in this model? Are you, which box are you in? Are you a substance abuser? Or are you substance dependent, right? And what a lot of people find out, even though they're a substance abuser, they go into some kind of treatment. Maybe, like I said, I've seen this happen. They go through a traumatic, like, job loss and family broke up, so they're depressed, they're drinking a lot. And then they go into treatment, they start straightening their life out. They don't drink, they get abstinent, and they never want to drink again. They don't even care whether they could or not, you know? So we want to look at some different things. Again, if you like this, it's sponsored by the Alcohol and Addiction Solution Facebook page. Click like and share, pass it around. We're trying to get information out there. And so what I wanted to just point out is, again, and we think about that, and we recently had a couple of big suicides, and you know, Anthony Bourdain, who by his own admission was a drug addict. And if you watched his show, I never really watched his show, but they were still showing clips of it. He would get sloshed in about half his show, right? So maybe he was fighting the addiction. Now, they say that when he committed suicide, supposedly he didn't have any drugs or alcohol in the system. But if you look at addiction as a malady, if you will, the alcohol or the drugs are a symptom. You know, what are you using the alcohol and the drugs to medicate? You know, in the United States, we have the opioid epidemic going on right now. And, you know, that's the one that's killing 175 people a day in the United States, just in the opioid epidemic. And of course, the medical model's answer is, hey, we'll just get them all on another drug, which will, you know, whether it's methadone or something like that. So we'll switch their addiction, right? Which I find kind of fascinating. But when you look at the regions of the country that have the highest ratio of people with the opioid epidemic, it's parts of the country that have lost hope. You know, like parts of West Virginia, parts of Kentucky, parts of the Midwest, where the coal mines are closing in the Appalachians, the steel mills, the auto plants are not what they used to be. So, you know, there's no hope for a lot of the people, or they think there's no hope. So they're self-medicating. They're much like our troops in Vietnam. They're in an unhappy cage. They're in a miserable cage, right? And so we need to get them, you know, happy. That's why you see people, you know, if they get clean and sober in those areas, if they're still miserable, what's going to happen then? Can we make them happy where they're at? You know, right now the whole focus is we'll get you off the drugs and the alcohol. And let's say you have a good insurance and you're in the Midwest and let's say it's wintertime, or and I pull you out of Detroit or Chicago in the middle of the winter and I bring you here to beautiful southern Florida where there's a boatload of treatment centers, or where not where Chris is, but south of Chris in Southern California, there's a boatload of treatment centers. So we bring you to where it's warm and it's a loving, nurturing environment. And people do great while they're in treatment. Maybe they even stay on and do some what they call sober living. We used to call them halfway houses, but they now they're called sober living. So, you know, or step down units where you kind of ease back into society, but you're being nurtured. You're in a community. You reconnect with people. And you do great. But then guess what? Then we say, okay, you're good now. Go home. So you go back into the unhappy environment. So unlike Vietnam, where the soldiers were unhappy over there, and they came back here where they were more happy, we're putting them back into a situation where it, can they get a good job? Can't, you know, if the coal mine is closed, or the steel mill is closed, can we give them an employment opportunity where they have hope? Can we help them re-acclimate into society that way? You know, or if we're putting him back into a hopeless situation, what's going to happen? So that's one of the things that's not being addressed in a lot of these treatment centers. And, you know, they work on, again, drugs bad, alcohol bad, let's get that out. But what's the underlying symptoms? What drove it? Is it fear? Is it anger? Is it non-connection? You've lost your connection. You know, again, in Vietnam, that's what happened to soldiers over there. They weren't really connected, and they were abusing alcohol. And the soldiers that came back, a lot of the ones that maintain a problem with it, besides having the genetic predisposition like an allergy, they were the ones that didn't have a connection coming back. A lot of those, right? And so what we want to do is look at addiction in a new way, huh? Because every day, especially in the hypnosis and the NLP world, we help people stop smoking and change their eating behavior, right? And, of course, smoking, much like drugs or alcohol, you can live the rest of your life, never smoke a cigarette. You can live the rest of your life, never drink alcohol. You can live the rest of your life, never do certain drugs, right? But we have to eat. And yet every day we help people moderate their eating because you have to eat just to live. And yet we haven't looked at some of those techniques and technologies of moderating, you know, which cue sets you off in certain patterns. One of the reasons when you look at how addictions work and when you look at how habits work, one of the reasons Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12-step model, which I personally like, especially if you're in that group where you have the allergy to alcohol. And to me, the biggest test, especially for alcohol, and you could do it for drugs, is a person without the allergy can have a beer and that's it. They're fine. They don't think about it. They don't want any more. They're good. A person with the allergy, if they have a drink, they want more. They want more. You know, if they have one pill, they want more pills. If they smoke one joint, they can't stop smoking joints. You know, as opposed to some people, they can smoke a joint or half a joint. They're fine. They're cool. They might not do it for a week or two. But if you have the allergy, it's basically the allergy manifests itself as more. You want more. So what we want to do is look at, you know, helping people modulate that. And again, why they say the 12-step program works so well is it doesn't matter what your cue is for the behavior. The routine is either drinking, or if you go to Narcotics Anonymous, the drugging, you know, and the reward is the feeling of relief. And so what they do with the 12-step model is whatever your cue is, let's say after work every day, you got to go have a beer. After work every day, you got to go, you end up starting to smoke and you smoke so much joint, you know, you smoke till you pass out, whatever it is, right? So they say if you make it to like a meeting, a 12-step meeting, an AA meeting or an NA meeting, well, once you're there, you get connection with other human beings. You connect with people. And so you get that relief that maybe you got in the bars or maybe you got with your drinking or your drugging buddies. You get in that new model. So it takes the same cue, gives the same reward, because the reward really isn't getting high or getting drunk. The reward is how it makes you feel. And so we've just changed the routine. So instead of going to a bar, going to the dope house, you're going to an AA meeting where people there hopefully are not drinking or drugging. And you still maintain that cycle, because the cycle of a habit is cue, reward, or cue, routine, reward. And so we just modulate. Again, this, if you like this, please click like and share. And it's the alcohol, it's sponsored today by the Alcohol Addiction Solution page. So please send people to it. We would greatly appreciate it. And again, for people that want it, for people that listen to the show, if they make a comment on that page and give me your email address, I will get you a copy of the book, The Alcohol and Addiction Solution, and a downloadable copy, you know, like a PDF file, basically. And so, because one of my passions is doing that. So again, it's the Alcohol and Addiction Solution page. And if you like it, click like and share. If you didn't like this, tell someone nothing. So that's just what I wanted to talk about. Because again, today, 175 people by conservative estimates are going to die from an opioid overdose. When you throw in the alcohol, DUI, you know, drunk driving deaths, mixed drug deaths, violent crime, all the other things, it's probably closer to 300 is the conservative estimates every day. And yet it's something that we can help. And so that's what I wanted to talk about today. Is I get a little kind of jazzed up on it because I get a little passionate about it. And again, have some fun with it. And so my mind hack, life hack for today is, again, it's look at your habits, and not even talking about alcohol or drugs. If you have a habit you want to alter, right? What you have to figure out is what's the cue for the habit? What starts the habit off? Is it every day at 3 o'clock you want a cookie? Is it every day after your dinner you need something sweet? So what's the cue? And then you know what the routine is. That's the habit you want to stop, or let's say stop a habit. So maybe it's cookies, maybe it's M&Ms, maybe it's whatever, ice cream, you know. So, and the reward is how it makes you feel. So if you break those down, you can begin to alter the habits a lot easier than you think. Because remember, the current research says willpower is like any other muscle in your body. It grows through time. The more you exercise it, the stronger your willpower becomes. There's a reason when people say, like, oh, Navy SEALs, Army Rangers, those must did certain things in the military. You have strong willpower. You built it over time. If you didn't develop it while you were in training, you didn't stay in the system. It's just the way it was. Same with very successful writers, or like Chris with a musician. When you look at the very successful musicians, they do their studio time. They do their practice time. They do what they have to do. So maybe next week we'll do a thing on habits, how to alter a habit. And a really cool one would be how to create a new habit. That's what we'll do next week, how to create a new habit given what you already do. Right? Because some of the current research is absolutely fascinating. So again, this was sponsored by the Alcohol and Addiction Solution. Please go to that page. It's a Facebook page. Like it. If you want the book, The Alcohol and Addiction Solution, leave me your email address. I will drop that to you in a PDF file so you can read it, because people need this information. So again, thank you for sharing with me. A big kudo to our producer, Mr. Chris.
Yeah.
And, so we'll see you as we trudge the road to happy destiny.
This has been No Limit People with Dr. Will Horton. Join us every week, Tuesday at 12 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and 3 p.m. Eastern Time, right here at Facebook Live and RadioBuzz.com.